From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last June when the mayor of Buenos Aires announced plans to transform his city's zoo into an ecological park instead. Mayor Horacio Rodriguez Larreta said, quote, "This situation of captivity is degrading for the animals. It is not the way to take care of them. Animals have to live in their habitat, not in the middle of buildings," end quote. Now, his announcement comes at a time when public opinion has shifted in recent years about zoos, marine parks, animals on screen. You may have heard that the Ringling Brothers Circus will close in May after 146 years in business. That comes after prolonged battles with animal rights groups over the treatment of elephants in the shows. Elephants were removed from performances last spring. Then there's SeaWorld, which plans to end all of its orca entertainment shows by 2019. But what about the education and conservation work of zoos, or marine parks, or large captivity organizations? Advocates point to zoos' breeding programs as essential in maintaining populations that would otherwise have gone extinct. And they say some zoos have a strong role even in reintroducing animals to the wild. So there's a lot to talk about here as we look at the future of animals in captivity, and I will open it up to listeners if you want to share your thoughts about the closing of the circus, which is one of the most immediate and recent news stories, if you want. Have your views evolved over time? We can talk about all of that. Let me welcome my guest for the hour. Dr. Don Rager is here. Don is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at St. John Fisher College. Dr. Rager, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Lawrence Torcello is here. He's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Does a lot of work in the realm of ethics. And so I feel like anytime ethics comes up, Dr. Torcello is there. And it's no surprise to me then to find out you're teaching a class coming up here on Peter Singer. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so for our audience who doesn't know, what's the story here?
Well, Peter Singer is considered to be one of the giants of the animal rights movement, sometimes thought of as the father of the movement, with books like Animal Liberation, really setting the philosophical conversation up until this day, you know, from the 1970s onward.
For you, Dr. Torcello, when you heard that the circus is going to shut down its run in May, 1 year after eliminating elephants from the show, after years of complaints about the treatment of animals and whether this is the right thing to do, what was your initial reaction to hearing about the circus closing?
That this is something that was inevitable, I think. The trend in terms of our awareness of animal rights issues and animal welfare issues, I think, makes that sort of thing, especially when you stop using animals that are highly intelligent like elephants, it becomes very difficult to justify any use of animals for our amusement and entertainment. And I think the circus predominantly plays on that. I'm as sentimental as anyone about the circus, but I think it's a good thing overall.
Okay. And you use the word inevitable. Does that mean you think that zoos and marine parks are going that way, or are they in a different category?
I think marine parks probably are. I think zoos will probably last a bit longer, but I wouldn't be surprised if it becomes, we get to the point where ecological preserves become the dominant way to get some of the same benefits that we currently take from zoos.
Okay, interesting. Dr. Rager, I think it's important to start out by mentioning the kind of work that you do and where you feel you have expertise to share, or at least insight to offer, because I don't want to put you in a position of answering questions that you feel might be slightly outside the scope of the work you do, but I do think your work in psychology, animal psychology, lends you a little bit of weight to at least first say, you know, did you hear about the circus and think, oh, that's too bad? Or did you think, same kind of thing, that was inevitable and maybe that's the right thing?
Actually, I do think, I agree that it was probably inevitable with our increased understanding of especially animal cognition. It's one of the areas that I've been keeping up with in recent years. Mm-hmm. And especially my focus is cognition in companion animals and domestic dogs in particular. But yes, I absolutely think that given our advances in the understanding of animal sentience in recent years, it makes sense that the public would become more concerned about.
And I should also say, by the way, that we did invite the Seneca Park Zoo, some of the really nice people who are often very generous with their time. And it's not that they're not now. They've indicated to us on multiple occasions they're just not available to come in for this program. But you're going to hear some sound coming up here on this program, some sound bites that kind of explain a little bit of some of perhaps their position. But just wanted to make sure we made that clear. So Dr. Rager, when it comes to the defense of animals in captivity, you often hear, well, there's a lot that we can benefit from. We can study, we can understand them better. Do you buy that? Can we conduct research that is valuable?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think a lot of our understanding of just the basic biology of the organism, as well as the psychology of the organism, is based on studies of captive animals. It would be very difficult to do a lot of that research probably in a natural environment.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Dr. Torricello, do you view captivity as a suitable place to study and to gain valuable insight?
I'm sure it is. I'm less sure about the utility of that, the information we get from animals in captivity in comparison to the amount of suffering that perhaps is placed upon the animals in captivity. I think we probably do learn an awful lot about how animals react to being constrained in captivity over the course of their lives. But I'm hesitant to use the word pathological, but it seems like we're probably learning a lot more about animals in a more pathological conducing state than we would want to know about them in their natural habitats.
What do you mean by that? Would.
Well, I think because these are really artificial conditions that we're studying them under, and I think we already know enough about them to know that this is a stress on the animals, so that the information we're getting from the animals in these conditions are information about animals that are in a condition that's already compromising their psychological health and physical health, probably, I'm sure.
Dr. Rager, any disagreement that studying them in an artificial environment is not as useful as compared to if you could study them in their natural environment?
Oh, no, I would agree. I mean, I do think the artificial environment is going to, the animal's going to behave very differently in that artificial environment in most cases than it would in a naturalistic environment. So you need to be careful about making generalizations.
And Dr. Rager, if I could, I just wanted to read a little bit of what the Ringling Brothers staff has said about elephants in particular. And again, if you missed that story, the Ringling Brothers circus is going to close after 146 years this coming May. But last May, they eliminated using elephants in the shows after years of complaints. And Ringling staff says the elephants need the stimulation of the circus, the lights, the sound, the interactions with people. They say life in their sanctuary in Florida, which is where they're going to be going, will be a difficult adjustment, and that it's better for them in the circus. I mean, I know you haven't necessarily been there to research and study that, but just hearing that explanation, do you buy that?
I think I would be careful about answering that. I think it would depend.
Okay.
It would depend on the individual organism. I mean, if we're talking about an animal that's been raised in captivity and that's used to a certain type of environment, it may well be the case that
socialized
from
a very early age,
right.
that's life.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Right. I think you could make an argument for that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Dr. Torricello, how do you feel hearing that?
Yeah, I mean, so even if I were to grant that argument, it still remains a case that it's self-perpetuating in terms of a condition that these animals are probably at a large scale better off not being exposed to. So if we have...
At all.
Exactly. So if we have animals that, in particular, are only used to being circus animals, I don't think that we could use that as an argument to support continued use of the circus, because if we already assume that this is not the best situation for animals, I don't think it becomes an argument for the circus just to say, well, we have to perpetuate it for the animals that we've already compromised.
Let me grab our first phone call of the hour. And I got to say, Keith in Pittsburgh's got a little bit of a different angle on this, but it's already making me think. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, thanks. A couple comments. When most people think of zoos, they think of basically mammals. And I agree with everybody. I don't think elephants should be in zoos because of the size of the elephant and the size of the space they get. It's just not in the right proportion. But Cincinnati has a whole building just dedicated to bugs. They have an insectarium. And I've been there, and I thought that was pretty cool. And then you have bird aviaries, such as you have on the other side in Niagara Falls, Canada. It's an old building that they repurposed. And you walk in there, and heaven help you if a bird poops on you, because they're all over the place. You're walking around with them. And then right up the river, they have the Butterfly Conservatory. So I think it, you might see zoos being repurposed to eliminate the mammals and going with other types of species. Now, I wouldn't want to have a monitor lizard, again, because you got the size and the space associated with the creature. But you could have a nice display, say, for some sort of tree frog or something like that, that might be suitable.
Keith, thank you for that. Dr. Torchella, do you agree?
I think that's a good point, that we shouldn't think of this as a one-size-fits-all approach that we need to be taking. And depending on the animal and the nature of the animal and the size of the animal, all these factors should go into considerations of how we treat that animal in captivity and how ethically permissible it is to even have that animal in captivity. So I think that's a fair point, and I don't have any disagreement, immediate disagreement against the idea that we should take species individually and consider them on an individual case.
Okay. Dr. Rager, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, animals have species-specific needs. And animals in zoos, zoos play such an important role, I think, in education and enabling people to get close to the animals and really develop an appreciation for them. So if we can accommodate their needs in a captive setting, and if the benefits are going to outweigh the costs, I think we should consider that.
Dr. Torchella, let me kick an ethical question your way. If we're looking at whether it's circus, zoos, marine parks, whatever the captivity scenario is there a central ethical question that should be consistent? And would it sound something like this? Is the purpose to benefit the animal or humans? In other words, are we claiming that this benefits the animals because we can do research about them, but that's just motivated reasoning because we want to put them on display and draw big crowds, whereas, you know, the benefit is for us, for our entertainment, maybe for money, maybe for profit? Or do we think, well, look, we are sort of a dominant species, humans, you know, and that's sort of the way of the planet. I know there are people who feel that way. Is that a central question that needs to be asked here? What's the benefit? Who benefits?
Yes, I think it is. And I think so I think the presumption is always against using animals. And so when we do use them, whether it's for food or entertainment, we have to have our reasoning in place, and we have to have good reasons and good justification for our use of the animal. And I think in the context that we're discussing today, I think we should be asking what benefit do we get, and what benefit does the animal or the species get? So I don't think we should be answering those questions in terms of just a human-centric point of view.
Okay. Dr. Rager, I know you're not an ethicist, but how do you feel about that kind of framing of the question?
No, I absolutely agree. I think we need to consider not only the human benefits to humans, but the benefits to the animals as well.
Okay. Chad in Henrietta has a question on elephants. Go ahead, Chad.
Hi. If we can't protect elephants in the wild, and apparently we can't, then how don't we have an obligation as a species to protect the existence, at least, of another mammal species?
But why can't we? Tell me what you say. Apparently we can't. Why can't we?
Well, I'm told from what I'm reading that in Africa, it's an endangered species now because of its poaching. And
which is what we do, right? That's us, right?
Well, that's true. But how do we as a Western nation, we apparently can't control that.
Okay.
So what do we have an obligation to maintain the existence of the species by at least keeping them in liberated captivity here like they do in Buffalo and in Washington and St. Louis?
Chad, it's a fair question. I want to thank you for the phone call. And before I let our guests respond, what I want to do, this is a perfect moment to go to a clip of a soundbite we have from Pamela Reed Sanchez, who is the executive director of the Seneca Park Zoo Society. Could not be here to join us today on this program, but she gave a TEDx talk in Rochester recently about the subject of captivity, the purpose of education and conservation, and what we might misunderstand when we look at stories like Cecil the Lion, Harambe. This is what Pamela Reed Sanchez had to say on the subject, and I think it flows right from what Chad is saying.
That romantic notion of in the wild, it doesn't exist much outside of our own imaginations. Where lions roam free, they're nuisance animals. They take down livestock that people depend on. Where elephants roam free, they destroy mass amounts of vegetation. And so we create national parks, sanctuaries, preserves, in a way to manage the species, manage populations, and ensure that humans and animals can live together in shared space. And we invite tourists in for safari. And yet, about every 20 minutes, an elephant is poached for its ivory. So if nothing changes at this rate, we're looking at extinction in about 10 years. You know, this leads to a role that zoos plays that I would venture most of you don't know about. Accredited zoos participate in cooperative and collaborative breeding programs that are designed to sustain a species, enough genetic diversity in that species, to sustain the population in conservation care for the next 100 years. This isn't done to perpetuate the existence of zoos. It's to ensure the viability of that species in natural range. By and large, when you come to the zoo and see an animal, that animal was born in a zoo. However, to ensure enough genetic diversity in a small breeding population, we have to occasionally introduce new genetics. So our lions came here from Africa in 2012. In Africa, they were considered surplus. A national park can only sustain so many lions. And our three lions were three lions too many. They could have become part of a canned hunt, but instead they came here to participate in a sustainable breeding population. And in fact, their offspring have already had offspring.
That's Pamela Reed Sanchez, Executive Director of the Seneca Park Zoo Society. You heard her mention poaching. You heard her say that our romantic idea of animals in the wild doesn't really exist. That's hard for some people to hear, Dr. Torricello. What do you think?
I think there's some tension in those two different points. So on one hand, the romantic idea of animals in the wild is sort of a fiction. But on the other hand, poaching is bad. And it seems like those are almost contradictory claims when I hear them. The first claim that these animals don't have the sort of place that we imagine they do in the wild would suggest that we should eliminate them from the wild and only have them in zoos. The second claim suggests that, but we want them in the wild, and zoos play an important role of making sure that the species perpetuates in the wild. So I think there's tension in that claim. I think that there are probably better ways that require more of an investment and more of a determined effort. An legal effort to actually care about managing populations of animals in the wild. But I think human beings are capable of doing that if that was actually something we were interested in doing.
Yeah, let me just follow that by asking Dr. Torricello, the reason I pushed Chad on this is because I said, you know, he says, well, poaching happens. And I said, well, poaching is us. Mm-hmm. Are we absolving ourselves of responsibility if we just say, well, you know, they're going to get poached, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, yes, people do venal or aggressive or violent things, but we can choose to find a way to do better. Mm-hmm. Are we absolving ourselves of responsibility if we just kind of pretend that poaching is almost like an act of God as mm-hmm. opposed to us?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a convenient argument to make. It kind of absolves of some responsibility to do better. I think it's true that zoos do play a role in preservation increasingly as species in the wild become more compromised. But I don't think that that's a good enough reason to not double down on our efforts, both legal and, you know, scientific efforts, to make sure that we're doing everything we can to preserve species in the wild.
Okay. Dr. Egger, anything you want to add there?
Well, I wouldn't disagree that we should be doing everything we can to preserve them in the wild. But I think despite our best efforts mm-hmm. to this point, we are failing on some of those efforts. And so what are our options when the species is on the verge of extinction? So I think I think it's a legitimate point.
Yeah,
that we're obligated.
This may be a practicality, and this may be a pragmatism versus idealism moment, and maybe it's not. I mean, again, maybe that's too defeatist. The pragmatist says poaching is happening, animals are facing extinction, we are not doing well with this, zoos can play a role. Mm-hmm. I think the idealist says poaching happens for a number of reasons, and it is complex. It is tied to a lot of different structures in society in terms of economic structures, ethical structures, all of those things, violence, acceptance of violence. Can we do better there? And so maybe it is a pragmatic versus idealistic. And what you're offering, Dr. Rager, is right now, pragmatism is probably winning because people realize that whether we like it or not is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Dr. Torchello?
Yeah, and I think that's right. But I would also add that if we're successful and the roles of zoos are increasingly successful, then the justification may ideally, I hope, vanish as we become more successful through zoo efforts in preserving. So that's at best a temporary justification for zoos.
I have a couple of emails from listeners asking us to kind of sort out the other recent news items regarding animal and animal welfare regarding the USDA. Let me read what I know and tell you what I don't know. I don't know how directly tied to the Trump administration this is. I see some jumping on this saying the Trump administration is doing X, Y, Z, or yeah. And I have to tell you, I don't know that. I don't know if this was in motion in advance. Let me just read some of the notes that producer Megan Mack pulled together, and then we can talk about this. Here they are. On Friday, the USDA removed animal welfare information from its website. Now, why? The USDA cited court rulings and privacy laws. It's unclear if this is temporary or permanent. It's also not clear if the decision was driven, again, by the Trump administration or exactly the genesis. The website provided access to records from inspections at thousands of research labs, zoos, dog breeding operations. So that's where a lot of the records were. The USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service cited court rulings and privacy laws for saying, you know, they're not going to post this right now. It said that the removed documents, which also included records of enforcement actions against those who violated animal welfare standards and the Horse Protection Act, by the way, would now be accessible only via Freedom of Information Act requests. And those can take years to be approved. Seven states require pet stores to source puppies from breeders who have clean USDA inspection reports, and this requirement could now be impossible to meet, so puppy mills with welfare violations may now be more off the radar. So there's a lot of possible consequences here. Dr. Rager, I don't know how much you followed this. What do you know about any concerns or thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah. I think transparency is really important. So I am opposed to having removed those documents. I do think they had taken steps to maintain confidentiality and of the parties involved. And so I don't think that's really a legitimate.
So what would drive this? I mean, again, we may be speculating here, but this to me is a very strange decision that looks like it's going to lead to more puppy mills, harder to track, more animals who are, you know, not really harder to make sure that animals are not abused or hurt. Any idea why?
Well, it doesn't seem strange in light of other events of recent weeks, I guess. So,
did you want to elaborate on that?
I mean, the lack of transparency in terms of, yeah,
okay.
Other research.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Dr. Torchello?
Yeah, I think it's perfectly consistent with the movement to end regulations coming from certain political segments of society. And especially, you know, with the Republican power hold right now, I think this is perfectly consistent with all of the other emphasis we see on deregulation. I think it's extremely unfortunate. I think that this sets up trouble that's going to be coming down the road. One of the good things about, you know, regulation is that it let me back step a little bit. So one of the good things about regulation when it comes to human beings is that it actually saves corporations and companies from lawsuits. And also the government gets spared from lawsuits because there are regulations in place. When it comes to deregulating an industry where animals are the ones who are predominantly in danger and suffering, those lawsuits aren't necessarily easy to get going anyway, since animals aren't bringing them to court. So this is really, for anyone who cares about the welfare of animals, this is just an awful, awful event. And it's true that privacy was already being considered. Names, private personal names, these were already being redacted. So that's really a bogus excuse. This is about deregulation. I think that's pretty clear if we just apply Occam's razor here.
Okay. Any recourse that you see for this, Dr. Torricello, that would turn this the other way?
Yes, people get ready to vote in 2018. And also, yeah, people arm themselves for lawsuits. I mean, so when I say arm yourself, I mean legally.
Yeah. To be clear, the emphasis is right. Not saying. Yeah.
Yes, of course. Right. Okay. People, people should be ready if they care about these issues to challenge them in court.
All right. Laura in Pittsford. I'll grab one more phone call before our only break of the hour. Go ahead, Laura.
Hi. Well, the conversation has moved on since I called in.
No, there's a wide range here. That's okay. Go ahead.
My point was about when we were talking about the poaching in Africa of the elephants and such, and the us and the we is where I see the problem in the conversation, because the caller who called in was talking about what we can do. We as in the United States, say, can't control necessarily the poaching there, other than putting pressure on other governments and stuff to control that. But we do have the opportunity to, as the Seneca Park director was saying, to help maintain those populations. It's such a difficult, it's not black and white, and what I could catch of this conversation that you have moved on to with the puppy mills and regulation of how we care for animals and stuff. In an enlightened society, if we don't take care of the people who can't take care of themselves and the animals who can't take care of themselves, then we're not really doing our job. But it becomes very difficult as you start moving down the line. I'm all over the place on this. I'm, of course, no zoos. The elephants shouldn't be in the circuses because they're mistreated. You tell me that, I'm like, absolutely, that makes perfect sense. And then at the same time, if you keep going down that line too, and is it really right to have dogs and cats as pets? You can go so far with this, and you could probably convince me that it's wrong for me to have a dog or a cat. That's not their natural state. We've created that over thousands of years. And so it's very difficult to have these conversations with people who, when they are so adamant that there's only one right way. I think zoos in and of themselves aren't evil. I think there are probably some zoos that, I know of myself just here in Rochester, when I see some of the mammals in small cages and stuff, it breaks my heart and it just makes me ill. But at the same time, you go to a zoo that has more money, that has more resources and is doing wonderful programs and has better habitats, and you can see the benefits of it. So it's really just a difficult situation. But we as a society, have to have some regulation, have to have some means of protecting animals, and at the same time continuing to know more about them and to educate ourselves and to be able to help them.
Laura, thank you. Dr. Torricello, anything you want to add there?
Well, in terms of, dogs and cats, I think that they're companion animals and they've evolved in a very close relationship with human beings. I, as long as they're being treated well, I don't have any principled objections to having such companion animals. I did want to go back and touch upon one thing I brought up previously with the regulations. I just want to point out that, we could have a conversation about whether or not we should be eating meat at all, but pushing that aside, the fact that we still largely eat meat in the society, those regulations also preserve our food and protect consumers. So even though, the point I raised was that animals are going to suffer, but this does have implications for human beings who are consuming animal products as well.
Okay. Dr. Rager?
I agree with the caller that it is, I think it's a very fuzzy situation sometimes. So, I don't think it's black and white. I think it's very difficult to weigh the costs and benefits and figure out where to draw the line in many cases. But I think regulation's important. I think transparency is important.
Okay. Well, Laura, thank you for the phone call. We're due for our only break of the hour. Let's get that. We'll come back to more of your phone calls. We're talking about a wide range of issues related to animal welfare going forward here. The circus is closing down in May after 146 years. They eliminated elephants from the program a year ago. Ticket sales have been down, and now the circus is shutting down. A lot of people are celebrating, but a lot of others have said, I love the circus, and sort of sad about this. If you want to weigh in on that, it's fine. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Got some more of your comments coming in about our, you know, different animals and different intelligence levels. Should we view them differently? We had a question from a listener named Alexis. Alexis, we'll hit that question on the other side. We'll also talk a little bit more about marine parks and how they may be viewed a little differently than zoos, for example, and what to expect there. So all of that straight ahead on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, and then there were two confirmed candidates for mayor of the city of Rochester. The first you heard on this program is former police chief and county legislator James Shepard. The second confirmed candidate is former journalist Rachel Barnhart. She's in the race, and she is joining us to discuss her plans, her vision, why she wants to be mayor of the city of Rochester. Join us. Talking animal welfare, the future of animals in captivity, and how we can be certain that the decisions we make regarding animals in any context are ethical decisions. Dr. Lawrence Torcello is here. He's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Dr. Don Rager. Dr. Don, you hear that all the time, Don. Dr. Don Rager is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at St. John Fisher College. And a brief hello to Gene Fisher, who's here on this very important week in February.
Thanks, Evan. You know, we all count on you to bring us discussions that are thought-provoking, serious, or even controversial. And in the last few weeks, just thinking back, we've talked about cybersecurity, immigration, anonymous news sources, Black history, music as political speech. And today we're tackling another really tough subject, animal rights, animal welfare, and the future of animals in captivity. As an animal lover myself, this conversation is a little hard for me because my friends will all tell you that my animals run the house and they let me live there with them. It's an important conversation.
I resemble that remark.
Well, you know, it is an important conversation, and it's one that's been going on for a long time. And I know we've got some really important aspects of it, including the idea of, you know, animals as not human beings, but sentient beings.
Yeah, kind of personhood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's a conversation that we can have on public radio because we are committed to civil discourse that respects all sides of the issues. But civil discourse is only possible when everyone supports it, when everyone is civil. And today we're asking you to be someone that helps support it in another way, who helps keep the conversation going. You can make a financial gift online at WXXINews.org, and you can also contribute at WEOS.org for folks that are listening in Geneva and the Finger Lakes. Your investment will help ensure the future of honest and accurate coverage of the issues that affect our community. Your investment supports intelligent perspectives and conversations that add so much to your life. Listener support is the lifeblood of public radio. More than half of our operating budget is contributed by people just like you who make monthly or annual gifts. $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever amount you choose will prolong important discussions like today's about animal welfare. Please make your gift now at WXXINews.org. or at WEOS.org. Thanks for listening, thanks for participating, and thanks for supporting Connections with Evan Dawson.
All right, Gene Fisher, thank you very much. And we are talking about animal welfare in a lot of different ways. We'll take some more of your phone calls, starting with Tina in Rochester next. Go ahead, Tina.
Hi, I'm Tina from Animal Rights Rochester, and I wanted to call in to talk about some of the choices that individuals have. Anyone feeling disempowered by the decisions made at governmental levels has the full power as individuals to take matters into their own hands every day. Every day we make choices whether to eat this or that, to wear this or that, be entertained by this or that. Veganism is peace for the animals, and we can choose that all the time. So we don't always have to wait for, you know, the circus cannot come to town, so forth like that. I wanted to hit on the USDA removing the database, because that does impact me. We used to use that We would use that to look these things up, and that's a tool that we won't have now. To do freedom of information law for a little organization like ours is very onerous. This is drawing the shades on information that could have helped animals.
Tina, you have any idea what you think? I mean, is either driving it, or were you surprised by this decision?
Well, if it's connected to the new administration, I guess not, because they seem to be opposed to regulation and having anybody interfere with business as usual. I don't know. I just don't know.
And are you thinking, or are you concerned about a proliferation, or at least a difficulty in rooting out puppy mills?
Yeah, anything that stops people from being able to shine a flashlight into the dark holes where animals are kept out of sight of the public, the things that go on in these places, it's hard to believe that they really are happening unless you can see a report.
So, Tina, before I let you go, you mentioned Animal Rights Rochester, which is what, by the way?
Well, we used to be called Animal Rights Advocates of Upstate New York, and we've just changed our name. We've been around for, I think, 27 years. And our mission is to educate the public on animal rights issues.
And where do they find you?
We're on the internet, arroc.org.
Well, thank you, Tina. Thanks for calling in. She mentioned a number of different subjects. I had a couple of emails just on the subject of animal personhood, which Gene Fisher mentioned. I'm going to get there in a second. I have an email from a listener saying, I can't believe you're not talking about food, you know, that you can't talk about ethics and animals and treatment without food. Dr. Torchella mentioned it briefly, but you predicted before the hour began that we'd be going to food eventually here. And Tina kind of mentioned it as well. How do you view food consumption in the issues of ethics? I mean, I think the spirit of the email I received was that. Ethics is veganism, you know, which I understand intellectually. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think all of the strong philosophical arguments, in my opinion, are on the side of veganism and vegetarianism. Yeah, and I think that surprises a lot of people. But in today's day and age, especially in the society we live in, where we don't depend on meat consumption for food anymore, which is to say that we can do pretty well and pretty healthily without it, it comes down to how much we really enjoy eating meat. And when you compare our enjoyment, the enjoyment we get out of it, with the immense suffering that really does go into industrialized agriculture, where most of our meat has to come from to support the large population that enjoys eating meat in this country, we're really talking about immense suffering of animals versus our gustatory satisfaction. And ethically, those things are just not on even playing fields.
Can I ask you to respond to something I heard this weekend in a conversation I was having at lunch? And I mentioned to someone I was having lunch with, you know, that the science is on the side of veganism in terms of health.
Yeah.
And it really is. I mean, I'm an evidence guy. Mm-hmm. And I've learned a lot in the last several years. I've tried to be very open-minded to that. It's pretty remarkable. And the person I was having lunch with said, I don't think so. And I said, you don't think so? And she said, you know, if you look at animals in the wild, some animals have more rounded teeth, they eat plants. Some animals have sharper teeth, they eat meat. We have both. I think we were designed for both. And I think that's the end of the story. What do you think?
I think that probably prehistorically we ate a lot of insects. And so if you want to really go far with that line of reasoning, then we should be eating a lot of insects now. That would probably be really great for us. But I think that we can do just fine without it. And I think because we overconsume meat, that's where the arguments come down on the side that you were advocating that.
And I guess evolution tells us that over millions of years, if we stop eating meat, our teeth will change. That's probably true.
Oh, yeah. Eventually, I suppose.
Not in my lifetime.
Right. Evolution goes very slowly. But, you know, the fact does remain that we can get along perfectly well without consuming meat. And because we do tend to overconsume it, most of the health impacts won't come from not eating it, but from eating too much of it. It's tied to many diseases that we know about, and the science is very good linking that. It's also in the argument, another aspect of the science is in terms of environmentalism. industrial, meat production contributes an enormous amount of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. And so from that point of view, the arguments are on the side of it as well. So health, environment, and ethics, really all of the, there's a lot of argument against eating meat and very strong, compelling arguments.
All right, Alexis writes to the program and wants to know if we should view animals differently and treat them differently based on what we understand about their intelligence level. And I think it kind of hints at the subject of animal personhood or this idea. And Dr. Rager, I'll start with you. Some thoughts about that. What do you think?
Well, I think it's actually very difficult to even define intelligence. We have difficulty defining it in our own species. And then I think there's probably species-specific variations of intelligence. So each species displays a different type of intelligence in its own niche. So then trying to compare species in terms of intelligence, I think that's very, very challenging.
So you don't like the idea of an ethical approach, or at least a treatment approach to animals in captivity, how we treat them at zoos, how we treat them in our communities.
I think it's a slippery slope.
A pig is different than a dog is different than a dolphin. Okay.
Cross-species comparisons in terms of intelligence.
Okay. Dr. Torchello, what does animal personhood mean to you?
First of all, I think that's right. Then there is a continuum of intelligence, and it's very hard to start making comparisons. On the other hand, philosophically speaking, the notion of personhood tends to refer to self-awareness, the ability to have robust relationships and make plans, a sense of a biographical sense of self as opposed to just a biological sense. It goes back to, it goes as far as John Locke, but actually even further to early founders of the church who found it useful to make a distinction between personhood in terms of human beings and divinities. Philosophically speaking, we tend to think of a person as somebody capable of sustained self-awareness and rationality akin to the kind we're used to in human beings. And while I recognize what Donna is saying as being absolutely correct, I think it is appropriate to say that certain species like human beings, chimpanzees, perhaps some dolphins, orcas, because of their capacity for self-awareness, social bonds. And this isn't to say that other animals don't have this. I think we probably underestimate the level to which other animals have this sort of awareness. But because, ethically speaking, what's really important is the ability to suffer. Human beings and other animals that have the sense of complex cognitive personhood that we're talking about could suffer in more dynamic ways. It's thought, right? So that isn't to say that animals who have a lower, and it's probably not the best way to even speak of this in terms of lower cognitive capacities, but for the sake of getting on with the conversation, animals who are thought to have less self-awareness on that scale of personhood are still morally relevant. There's a baseline moral relevance that comes into play whenever something is sentient enough to suffer. But that doesn't prevent us from making nuanced comparisons between the amount of suffering a particular species is capable of. And I think that we have to do that. And I think that helps us sort through ethical questions when we begin to make those distinctions.
You mentioned dolphins and orca. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about what we think the future of marine parks is. SeaWorld saying that, Megan Mack, tell me if I'm right on this, that by 2019, no more orca at SeaWorld. Is that correct? Is that roughly correct, Megan? She's going to send a note to make sure that I'm right on the numbers there. But the bottom line is we've seen a lot of shifts, even in marine parks. I want to first ask both of our guests. A lot of people, I think, have indicated they don't view SeaWorld the same as a zoo, that you're taking a whale, you're taking marine life that would have almost sort of an endless ecosystem and place to live, and putting it in the equivalent of a human bathtub, a human in a bathtub, and telling it to live in there. And that feels something akin to torture. And others I know may feel differently. Don, have you viewed marine parks any differently for those reasons?
Well, I think it depends, again, on the species and their needs. So something like an orca, yeah, or dolphins that have a wide range. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think their needs are being met in an aquarium, but I think there are probably plenty of other marine species that could comfortably be housed and have their sort of species-specific needs met in that kind of environment.
Okay. Dr. Torchello? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. And this, to me, to my mind, relates back to the notion of personhood, because I think that orcas have the sort of reflective self-awareness, as far as I know. And I think that it's really hard to make a case for animals of that capacity to be confined over the course of their life. And I would say the same about elephants. I would say the same about chimpanzees and gorillas. It's a much different, it adds ethical dimensions to the problem.
Producer Megan Mack reminds me that what the change is coming for SeaWorld, for example, is that there will be no more orca entertainment shows. San Diego already ended them last month. Florida and Texas parks are going to end them by 2019, but all parks will consider orca encounters and experiences. So you may still see orca at SeaWorld. You're just not going to see the tricks, that kind of stuff. I mean, the tricks of an orca at SeaWorld always felt like, you know, looking at a circus, making an elephant sort of kneel because you can. And Dr. Rager, when animals are trained to do that, is there any way for us to know psychologically if that is harmful to them in any way? I mean, I think now, with the sentimentality or the sentiment and the sensibilities we have changing, it feels vulgar to me to look at orcas being forced to jump through hoops or an animal to circus jumping through a ring of fire or an elephant being forced to kneel just because you can make it do that. Psychologically, is there enough research, or can we gain anything about what they might be feeling that way?
Well, I think some of the current research on animal cognition is giving us some insight into that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can't generalize across species, okay, but certainly for certain species, like the dog, for example, domestic dogs, they actually enjoy solving problems. They enjoy, you know, that working relationship a lot of times with their caregivers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, and tricks is kind of part of that with dogs, you know, jumping, catching the ball, things like that.
They like solving problems, and so those are challenges for them a lot of times, you know. So, right.
All right. So we shouldn't just assume that that's always a bad thing for the animal.
That's right.
But it may be different species to species. Dr. Torchello, does it look vulgar to you, or do you think again, it's a little more complex than that? Am I being naive or soft here?
I share your sense of vulgarity, but I also think it's true that it's more complex than that. And I do think that animals who have a more complex sort of cognitive existence do like stimulation and perhaps could even enjoy some of these interactions. But I think that that's still no justification for taking them out of their natural environment where they're especially creatures that exist in a pod and have social relationships that, of course, are going to be stimulating to them.
Yeah, speaking of relationships in a pod, I mean, that's something that I don't have the expertise to talk about. Well, when you read briefly about this and you hear about orca, dolphins existing in pods, and then all of a sudden you're sort of singularly in captivity. That, to me, Dr. Rager, would seem psychologically very difficult for animals that are used to being in groups.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure that has I would suspect it has a serious impact on their psychological well-being, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as we get ready to wrap here, one other idea of where we may be going in the future is that we may be moving into a world where a zoo is more of a virtual reality experience, or a marine park, in that there's so much we can do with technology. Can we recreate the experience without actually forcing the animals into this position? And I don't know that we can. And I know some will say there's nothing like the real thing. But I wonder if that's part of where we're going, because otherwise you have this debate about, do you keep everything the same? Do you create these sanctuaries where there have been some debates on what really is a sanctuary and what is not, and what is really better for the animals? Dr. Torchello, where do you think we may be going?
I think that's a really interesting prospect. Again, the benefit we get, to my mind, from keeping many of these animals in captivity is of marginal utility, so that if we could recreate it with technology and get a similar benefit, I think that that's well worth doing.
Okay. Dr. Rager?
Well, I think it's an empirical question. I don't really know what research exists on the benefits, for example, to the animals themselves. I mean, there clearly are benefits, but I don't know the extent to which they compare with the costs. And so I would like to see more research, actually, on some of that, some of those questions.
Okay. Says the researcher. That's we always want better research, right?
Right.
We always want more evidence. And in the last 30 seconds or so, if we were taking your class with your students this spring on animal welfare, what would we learn?
Well, I guess to crystallize it, I just want to repeat, the presumption should always be against using another species for our own benefit, whatever that is. And so when we do, I think we have to make sure that we can justify it to a very high degree. Yeah, especially when it's usually for our entertainment.
Do you find students come into your class having not really thought about that often? Is there a general way to describe their disposition to this?
You know, I think it's changing over time. I'm finding that students are coming to class having thought about these issues much more than perhaps they did a few years ago. And I'm finding that vegetarianism and veganism is becoming much more common on college campuses.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Dr. Lawrence Torricello is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Nice having you. Thank you for being here.
Great being here. Thank you.
Dr. Don Rager is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at St. John Fisher College. Dr. Rager, thank you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Mike Black, who's engineered this hour, and Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk with you Tuesday on member-supported Public Radio.